welcome to the 51st episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Google celebrates John Wisden's 187th birthday, welcome to the podcast that he probably wouldn't have listened to.
So we're celebrating Wisden's 187th birthday too, and we're celebrating it by reviewing David Kynaston's book, WG's Birthday Party. We've got an interview with Peter De La Penna. We're going to talk about England poaching Ireland's players, and we're going to be looking at Scotland's T20 Centurion. But just going back to this Irish thing, one of my highlights of the last 2 weeks was actually the fact that we've kind of now got a new fixture on our minds, which is the England-Ireland tussle, a little bit like we have the Calcutta Cup.
It felt like, I know it could be described as a warm-up game because you had England sending over a weaker side, but it felt like...
And because they played some 2020s and those sports, you know, well...
But it felt like a proper contest. It felt like, you know, I'll tell you what a measure of it was. People in my office were sitting around listening to it, and I think that's a good measure
of
it.
Yeah, and people, I was worried halfway through the England
innings. Yeah, it was a good contest. There were 10,000 people out watching it, and you suddenly thought, maybe we've got the burgeoning of a new rivalry.
I think there are two things there. One of which is, it's a good contest. The other thing is that actually you need to get to know the players. That's the important thing. We all know the England players, but you know, Ireland we don't see on the scene all that much. But we've seen them more and more recently, and actually it's familiarity which is the thing that...
And I actually think on the basis of this game, would you object to a regular series between the sides? Would you object to this being a three-match series? No, we really wouldn't have. And I think that says a lot about... Well, credit to the Irish, and credit to them actually for creating a buzz around the game. Getting a crowd there.
So I've been watching international cricket. You've been watching something on a slightly smaller scale.
I've been playing. So this Sunday, as on most Sundays, I took the field for the mighty Pinkney's Green CC and was confronted by the opposition, the mighty BBC Bushmen, their second change bowler, a 73-year-old off-spinner. And this, I was in awe of this man in so many different ways. I mean, let's be clear of this. We're all told repeatedly that, you know, your physical peak is so short, it's so brief, your sporting career is so fragile. And
here mine was about 35 seconds.
Well, exactly. We get to the top of the mountain and descend pretty rapidly. And here is a man who dearly, dearly loved the game. He's loved it all his life and has refused to let it go. And is still getting satisfied. And by the way, accrediting himself very nicely. I mean, bowled very well.
Well, that's the thing. Cricket is a great, great leveler. I play for my... I haven't played this summer, but I usually play for the third team for my cricket club. And, you know, you get an age range from sort of 10 years old through to 85 years old. And actually, there's that thing that you go out to bat and you have no idea. You see someone trundling up from the other end and they can be 10 or they can be 85. Mm. And you have no idea whatsoever what their kind of level of talent is going to be.
I think what was really nice about this is that it connects, as you've said, it connects generations that don't normally connect. I mean, at one point, this guy was bowling to one of our Colts players. And you think, in what other environment does a 73-year-old and a 15-year-old approach each other as equals? And I think it's a pleasure. And I think for all of us, it should be something that we should be excited about.
I mean,
the fact that we should keep plodding on.
This is why we love cricket. In short. So talking of spinners who are past it. Actually, maybe that's harsh. But Samit Patel is someone who I think both of us have followed with a bit of interest over the last few years. He's clearly an incredibly talented cricketer, and he's also clearly one of those people for whom talent is never enough. And there's always been something missing, and the thing that's missing is his ability to actually have, to be able to have a good relationship with the English cricket board. In the past, it used to be about his fitness, and, you know, we've debated that on the podcast, whether we should care about fitness. But yesterday or the day before, he came out and he had this made this ridiculous statement in which he talked about his own, the fact that he hadn't been selected for the England one-dayers and, the shortened format of the game more generally. He said that he was quite disgusted by the description. And you just think, well, look, for someone who has so much talent, to have so little ability to actually manage it.
Well, we've talked before in this podcast about the limits of talent, and I think Sandy Patel is a great example of that. The ability is there for all to see, but his failure to knuckle down... I think what's sad about this is that I can always understand a player's frustration in not being selected, but let's contrast it with someone like Nick Compton, dropped, I think, in a very unfair circumstance early in the summer, who dealt with, in a lot of ways, with a lot of good grace, and I think it does players a lot of credit. And more pragmatically, it keeps you in the selector's good books.
Well, it does. There are some people who just get selected and you know they're not going to get dropped for a long time. Joe Root, is one of them. He is the kind of person who you know the English establishment likes. Whereas someone, unfortunately, like Samrat Patel, he just puts his foot in it in all the wrong places.
Patel, unfortunately, is now at an age where it really is, it's do or die in terms of his career. And I think it'd be very sad if he goes on to be remembered as a kind of a what if, a nearly cricketer. Yeah. But sadly, I think that appears to be the way it's going. Yeah.
So, Andy, most of us, you said you're playing cricket at the weekend. Most of us spend our weeks working in between. But you've been bucking the trend.
I did something yesterday that all of us should do more of, which is I took the day off and went to the Oval. And frankly, having discovered that this is a legitimate thing to do, that you can just take the day off work to watch cricket, I'm going to do this far more often. Beautiful day. Second day of the County Championship, London Derby between Middlesex and Surrey. At this current point, this is sounding massively like a highlight. And in many ways, it was. What a wonderful day. Ollie Rayner.
And you were there with your father. I mean,
I was there with my father, who brought an M&S picnic to be proud of. You know, more pork pies consumed than a man should reasonably.
God, we love cricket. We love
Ollie Rayner, the young Middlesex spinner. Not so young anymore. He's been a prospect for a while, but he's really fulfilled his, starting to fulfill his potential. Took 8 for 46. The thing that was depressing about this, though, that it came in a Surrey performance that was utterly spineless. And I am a Surrey fan of sorts. I mean, it doesn't bring me to tears when they fare awfully. But what it really made me think was the fact that cricket requires commitment on both sides, and it slightly took the gloss off Rayner's achievement that actually Surrey were just throwing their wickets away again and again. They were wantonly over aggressive shots for the circumstances.
Surrey have gone down a really interesting route in, well, basically spending lots of money and getting lots of big names in and sort of building a squad that way. I mean, I know absolutely nothing about football other than that you kick the ball in, but it seems the kind of Manchester City way to build the squad. And actually, it has left them spineless in both the sense that they don't really have an identity, but also when you hear about things like that, you actually see them being literally spineless in the sense that they don't have that ability to kind of knuckle down and get through these sort of press situations.
From the archives, and this week, Scotland were roundly trounced in their home ODI at Edinburgh against Australia. Now, whereas the Australian team may have had all the really big names, the Scotland side did contain one of only 10 players to score an international T20 100.
And this was exactly the thing that interested me. When we were watching Aaron Finch's 150, not to immediately overshadow Richie Berrington, who was in the Scotland squad for that game. When Aaron Finch made his 150, I was thinking, yes, this is what T20 is all about. You know, it's about the great names of the game amid all the razzmatazz, amid all the money, making big runs. And then, in fact, I went on to Cricket Info and I looked at the list of the people who had made international T20 hundreds, and there were only 10 of them. And the seventh one was someone from Scotland. And that made me sort of, well, it made me think that there must have been something of a backstory behind this, and of course it was one Richie Berrington who is still playing, and he made that century in a game against Bangladesh, in fact, and it was a game against Bangladesh in the unlikely setting of The Hague, and it just struck me as sort of as slightly odd in this form of the game that's sort of taken over the entirety of the world. But here we had someone playing for one of the associate nations, and they played one of the innings that was in the top 10 innings that had ever been played in the international form of this game.
I suppose there was always this theory that T20 might act as a leveller. I'm not really sure to what extent it's really come to pass, but there was always a theory that associate nations might be able to compete that bit more in the T20 arena. I suppose one thing that's pretty creditable about the innings is that you made the point that it was against Bangladesh, who, although the weaker of the Test nations, they're still a Test nation.
Exactly. It wasn't against a no one. I think that's the important thing to point out. Let's just go back and look at Richie Berrington as a cricketer, because I have to say I hadn't actually really come across him. In fact, this innings had passed me by until I saw this list of the top T20 innings. Like all of the best UK cricketers, he was born in South Africa. He was born in Pretoria, but he moved over here as a young child. He moved up to Scotland, and he sort of became a pin-up for Scottish cricket development.
Does Scottish cricket have pin-ups?
Well, I mean, insofar as they do, they have Richie Berrington. And actually, this is something I want to come on to, because I'm really sorry, Richie, if you're listening, but actually, he's not very good, actually. It's the ultimate reality of it. He started playing off for the under-15s. By the time he was qualifying for the under-17s. He, in fact, played for the under-19s. I mean, this is young talent, if ever there was it. He played in the under-19 World Cup in Sri Lanka in 2006. But then, as a 19-year-old, he was sent off on the ICC's European Cricket Academy. And I have to say, I know absolutely nothing about the ICC's European Cricket Academy. But what I think it is something that's designed specifically to bring through players who don't qualify for academies, you know, established academies, basically, in England.
It is fascinating the number of South African immigrants who've gone on to make a creditable cricket career elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as a country, if we actually... I mean, that's a good From the Archives feature in itself. We were actually boiled down an 11 of brilliant South African immigrants.
Or actually, you could look at the effect on English and now Scottish cricket. If you took out all of the... You know, from Basil D'Oliveira all the way through, took out of all of the South African imports, what effect that would have had on the kind of status of cricket. But anyway, Richie Berrington was, you know, very much brought into the fold. In 2010, he was offered a full-time professional contract with the Scottish Cricket Union, or whatever it's called. I have no idea what the equivalent of the ECB in Scotland is, the SCB, let's call it for the time being. But the reality is that he never has been a particularly good cricketer. I mean, he averages, I've got it here, he averages 21 in ODIs with the bat and 22 in T20s. Actually, his bowling average is kind of better. In 2020s, his bowling average is 19 and he has an economy of 7, which actually isn't that bad. And it just makes it absolutely remarkable that suddenly here we are in this game, Scotland against Bangladesh. This boy, yeah, he's a pin-up for Scottish cricket, but let's face it, that doesn't mean all that much. And suddenly here he is, putting himself up among the top 10 2020 innings of all time.
The point, I suppose, is that record list... I mean, it's that odd, like, consistently overquoted cliche about how, you know, damn lies and statistics. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the thing is, to set a record requires only one great performance in a lot of cases. And it's why, actually, you can be Richie Berrington in that list, because you just need things to go for you on one day.
Well, it would be interesting, actually, to talk a bit more about, you know, this idea of 2020 being the, you know, being the arena in which sort of anyone can be a hero. You know,
the records are also new, though, aren't they? I mean, they're there to be set. They're there. I mean,
yeah, but there've been this is the other thing that surprised me. There are a lot of quality players who have played 2020, and there is a lot of international 2020 cricket that has happened over the last 5-6 years. The interesting thing about this, just to run through this game between Scotland and Bangladesh. I mean, to be honest, it was a completely dull game. Scotland went out, batted first, scored 162 for 7, which is, when you think that someone made a century, tells you about the rest of the batting card. I mean, it's a fairly typical Scotland batting performance here, really. And then the Bangladeshis, who, you know, they didn't have their... you know, this wasn't the Bangladesh C team. They had, you know, Shakib Al Hasan, who for a while was at the, you know, the top of the limited rankings playing. And they couldn't get near, and they got to 128. Again, that's something that can happen in 2020 cricket, the fact that good batting lineups go for nothing. But do we think that actually this is the kind of thing that we're going to see more of? The kind of thing that where you're going to have freak innings from batsmen who just go out there and then they're just going to come out onto the scene for...
I think the point is that 2020 is more rewarding than most formats in the sense that it encourages, there is a permit to play with brazen aggression in 2020, which batsmen don't have in other games. And if you almost just do this by statistics and by odds, if you do that enough times, if you have a half-decent eye and you go out swinging enough times, the idea that you'll have an innings where things go connect.
But the thing that kind of refutes that is just the statistics, that there are only 10 people who have scored 2020. I mean, the person who I keep on coming back to is the person who, Graham Napier, who when 2020 cricket first came out, he was the one who played that extraordinary innings for Essex. And on the back of that, he got a massive reputation. And then he sort of never really did anything with
had
it.
His moments,
he got an IPL contract, he played a bit for England and everything like that. But it's kind of, it just seems odd to me that there have only ever been 10 2020 hundreds and that one of them is by a Scotsman.
I guess it'd be interesting to see whether it remains a gold standard. Or as the game goes on, will scoring a 2020 100 become easier? Will it become a less significant achievement?
to the book review. And this episode, I have to admit that Amazon has slightly let me down. And the book that we're going to review, I haven't read it. So I'm going to be interviewing Andy on the subject of David Kynaston's WG's birthday party. There's a quote on the back from the Wisden Cricketer that says of it, "For a flavour of the man, and especially the cricket he played and the men he played with and against, it is perfect." Do you think that sums it up?
Kynaston is a historian by profession rather than a cricket writer, and the way he's approached this book is very much like a history book. It's full of very in-depth, very serious research. The premise is around the 1898 game between the gentlemen and the amateurs, which was specially moved to coincide with WG's birthday. And the really interesting sort of technique behind the book is it's effectively an extended match report of that game, but connected to a bit of a biography of WG Grace, reflection on lots of the players involved, and reflection of the cricket of the time.
So one of the things that's always struck me about WG Grace is that he's just, you know, he's a huge character in the game. Anyone who knows, who doesn't even know about cricket, knows the name of WG Grace. Did you feel that you kind of got a bit behind that myth? You're talking about Kynaston being a historian. Do you think you got sort of to the truth a bit?
I think there are two things here. Firstly, I think the portrait of this game shows very clearly how much of a legend Grace was in his time, the way he was worshipped by the public, in a way that actually I don't think it's possible for a sportsman quite to be almost now. Although, you know, I say that in a week where thousands of people turned up in Madrid to watch a Welsh footballer get signed, so I suppose there is that. But the sheer hysteria, and also, I guess, the kind of good feeling towards Grace, the almost uncynical good feeling. There was also, I thought, a very interesting other side that came across in this book, which is that we all know, I think anyone who's read anything about Grace, that there was an arrogance to him. There was the, you know, they've come to watch me bat, not you bowl, and the kind of shamateurism of him, the fact that he earned far more than any of the players. There was a very interesting part in the book talking about the way he'd always look out for younger cricketers. He was very defensive of their interests. He always turned out to play in professionals' testimonials. He took it very seriously. He knew his presence would give that guy £2,000.
And that he had a duty.
Yeah, and he took that very seriously. So for me, it actually came across, this sort of slightly arrogant oaf, actually, that's slightly quite often portrayed, actually came across in this book as a lot more considered individual.
You have, and in a sense, it seems to me that he was actually quite ahead of his time in terms of the kind of commercial aspects of the game that he... Because actually, I don't know whether this... we didn't set this up, by the way, but when you said his quote... they came to see me bat, not you bowl. I think that's actually a misquotation, isn't it? Is it not? They came to see me bat, not you umpire, which is what he said to an umpire that gave him out and he put the bells back on. And actually, it throws into quite interesting relief, you know, when we've just watched a test series that has been completely marred. Well, not marred, but where umpiring has sort of become the centre of the thing. And actually, someone saying we've come to watch cricket, not people umpiring cricket, is actually quite an interesting perspective on that.
Well, I think Grace's attitude was very clear in that he would have shared Stuart Broad's sense, I think, that, you know, you wait to be given, and that sense, and that's why one of the things that's quite interesting in terms of the way sportsmanship's evolved. One really nice idea in this book, I think, is the way that the 22 individuals involved in the game are each given a small biography. And I think this is quite to an individual's taste. I think some people will find this a bit bitty, a bit almost kind of lounge table sort of book, you know, lots of little biographies. But I enjoyed it. I think it's such a pleasure. I think it's always wonderful to read about these Victorian cricketers and their lives. I've got a couple of wonderful stories. We have Andrew Stoddart, opener for the gentlemen. He scored a world record 485 for his team, the Stoics, a feat made more remarkable by the fact he'd been up the whole night before playing poker. Still fresh after his monster innings, he followed up with a lawn tennis foursome, a box at the theatre, and a supper party. And you think, this is wonderful. It's these multitasking, multifaceted cricketers that we don't get anymore that are rather lovable.
And you talk about Kynaston being a historian, and historian in the sense of talking about WG Grace. Do you get a sort of sense of the culture of the time as well? Because, you know, the late Victorian culture, which was the city. A thing in and of itself.
I think one thing Kynaston is very, very strong on is the way in which cricket's development was, it was unbelievably fast. And he's very clear on the fact that whenever you look back at the success of something, its success seems inevitable. But he's very clear on the fact that barely, certainly 100 years before this game, I mean, cricket was not in any way at the heart of British culture. It just wasn't. It, in many ways, it was still seen as quite peripheral by a lot of people. And he showed the sheer speed with which it was picked up.
And was that W.G. Grace who was responsible for that?
Well, I think W.G. Grace... It kind of seems very clear that W.G. Grace played a key role in it. He doesn't choose to make a judgment on whether without Grace we would have ended up where we ended up. I think he's very, very strong in saying that, and I think this is true actually to this day, that cricket's always had this particular appeal because it represented this idyllic, perfect England. And I think Kynaston's very strong in this. This idea that cricket represented far more than a sport. It represented this ideal of green fields, even in the centre of London.
Yep.
And, you know, things
and this
like,
was a London that had just been through the... Well, a country that had just been through the Industrial Revolution and, you know, everyone moving into the cities and, you know, losing that kind of pastoral idyll somehow.
And I think he's strong, as a historian would be, he's interested in the gentleman versus players divide, but he's also a bit more, I would say, slightly more nuanced on it. He reflects on the fact that actually, the way in which the counties supported players also became a method by which they controlled them, and that was something that actually previously, in the old days of like touring all-star England teams, hadn't been the case. So I think it's a really interesting analysis, the way counties were both the salvation and the kind of damnation of professional players.
To the interview, and this episode I spoke to American cricket journalist Peter De La Penna. I began by asking what had first sparked his interest in the game.
I grew up loving sports, grew up in New Jersey, and any sport we could play growing up, me and my brothers did, and I always thought that after a certain point in time when I realized that I was never going to make it professionally as an athlete, I wanted to become a journalist and either cover the New York Giants or the New York Mets or the New Jersey Devils or any of the local area sports teams or any other U.S. pro sports. And I always thought it would be football or baseball mainly, but when I was in at university, I spent a semester abroad in Australia, and the day I landed, I got off the plane, and the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald headline said, "Bloody hell, these Palms mean business." And it caught my eye, and I started to read the recap, and it might as well have been in Chinese. Thought, what the hell is this? You know, what's LBW? What's Carter Mid-On? What's the difference between a wicket? All these things are completely foreign to me, but I thought, if this is on the front page of one of the major daily newspapers in Australia, and I'm going to be here for the next 6 months, I should probably try and make an effort to get to learn this if I want to fit in here. And tried to watch the rest of the first test at Lord's. That was the front page of the first day's recap of the first test at Lord's. And you could pick up certain things from just watching on the television. You know, Shane Warne's bowling, and he hits the stumps and he goes out of his mind, and everybody's running around crazy and celebrating like it's the final out of the World Series. And so it was pretty obvious when somebody got out. You couldn't miss it. You'd have to be pretty stupid to not realize when somebody got out. And
I think you'd have been as drawn in if you hadn't happened to start watching a team as talented as that Australian side was. Do you think the game would have had enough to draw you in, or do you think you were almost lucky enough that the first team you watched happened to be one of the greatest of all time?
This is something I'm in the process of working on a project about and writing more in depth about it, but it's something I've often pondered deeply about, because I feel like to a certain extent I was very fortunate to kind of stumble into cricket at that particular moment in time, and I'm not sure if I really would have been captivated in the way I was if I had stumbled on cricket during a different series. And I mean, the first test I understood the rules to. In between the first and second test, I sat down and was grilling a kid who was in one of my he was around the university housing complex where we were, and I just grilled him for 2 hours, and he was very patient with me. And the next night, the second test at Edgbaston starts, and it just happens to be one of the greatest tests of all time.
Cool.
And that was the first test I understood the rules to, and how could I not be hooked? after watching that match. And
no, for that to be your first test you're really into is sort of unbelievably fortunate. I mean, given that that was seen as one of the greats of all time. I wonder, was there something, you've kind of mentioned Warne, and I've seen you mentioned Warne as well on your Facebook page, and I wondered what particularly was it about him? Because I guess once you got more into the game, you could appreciate the skill he had with the ball, but what was it sort of instinctively that made you think this guy is very special?
Well, he was very charismatic. It didn't matter if it was cricket or baseball or basketball or tiddlywinks. If somebody is a star, there's something that they just ooze out of their personality, and he just, everything he did was eye-catching. And I remember watching the first day of the second test. I forget if it was on a Wednesday or a Thursday. I'm pretty sure it was on a Thursday because I had classes Monday through Wednesday. So a lot of times on a Thursday, I was up to no good, and I'd wander into Sydney and go hang out at the casino and play blackjack during the afternoon. And so at night, the casino had a giant projection screen where they would show the test match on, but they had the audio turned on. They had audio turned up on, I think it was the horse racing, but they had the sound on mute. So the first session I watched in the casino, and it was on mute, but every over, it seemed like at some point during the course of six balls, the camera panned to Warne. If he was fielding the slips, or if he was chewing gum, or if he was discussing some sort of strategic point with Ricky Ponting, or whatever it was, the camera was on him. It was obvious there was a reason why the camera was on him, because this guy is the star. And then, you know, he gets the ball in his hand, and before long, he takes, I'm pretty sure he took the first wicket. I think he broke the partnership between Triscothic and Stress. And you know, I was like, oh, why hadn't he come on sooner? Why didn't Ricky Ponting toss in the ball earlier? And, of course, he should have given the ball to Warne, because he was the guy who was going to take the wicket. And just if you're a fan of sports, you recognize the characters who are appealing and just pleasing to the eye aesthetically. If it's LeBron James or Kobe Bryant or Derek Jeter or Mike Trout, or if it's Wayne Gretzky, or
they will all, you can see that almost before you really,
you don't have to know really much about the sport to realize you're witnessing something special.
No, I think you seem to have been incredibly blessed, I think, at the time you got into the game. I wondered if we could move to what I guess is your real, true specialist subject, which is American cricket. And I do take a real interest in the development, not just of the US, but of kind of all the associate nations. And I've read with interest a lot of your stuff on Crick Info about the various challenges that US cricket's had over, I guess more than just the last 12 months. I mean, I wondered if you could kind of sum up what you see now as the key obstacles to US cricket moving forward.
Well, where to start? I mean, infrastructure and grassroots, lack of infrastructure, lack of into grassroots. If you compare, for example, to just among the other associate countries, Ireland, for example, I think, according to the last ICC survey, they have somewhere around 160 or 170 turf wickets, and Ireland is the size of, I don't know, New York State. Ireland itself is not very big country land-wise, and America, the vast expanse of territory, there are only 21 turf wickets, according to the ICC data survey, in the entire country. And there are, I think, 300 or 400 artificial wickets. But if you're not having turf wickets, and you're not being able to experience the international standard and what your players are going to be playing on if they go off to international tournaments, that's not going to help your players to develop properly. And even more importantly than the actual wicket itself is the outfields. Some of the outfields are just the most god-awful, just disgraceful and just extraordinarily discouraging facilities to play on. I mean, I remember countless times where you get a overpitched delivery and you want to smash it through the covers, and the ball will travel 15 feet in the grass before it stops dead, and it's the most, it's so soul crushing. That's the one word that always comes to me. It's soul crushing. You want to play technically correct, and you can't do it. And if you can't play technically correct, your technique goes to hell, and all the guys who are playing around the U.S. in club cricket and regional cricket, all they do is just mow across the line.
It's a terrible way to prepare for international cricket. But it's, in terms of who's responsible for this, because often people look to the ICC and say, look, they need to do more to develop the associate nations. Is that what you see as the solution, i.e. the ICC need to be doing more here? Or is this purely a domestic issue that someone at the American level needs to kind of take responsibility for?
There's plenty of blame to go around, but I think more of it has to do with the lack of initiative and the lack of inspiration from the people within the U.S. in the administration. I mean, everybody is kind of looking out for themselves, and they're not really looking to help their neighbor or really foster growth for the greater good, I guess, is one way of putting it. And in terms of grassroots especially, I mean, putting aside the infrastructure problems, there's no emphasis on youth cricket and just building a community spirit. If you experience club cricket in the UK or Australia, but definitely in the UK, many people in your audience will take for granted the fact that you go to a club in the UK, you have a first 11, a second 11, a third 11, a fourth 11, and then you have an under 11, an under 13, an under 15, an under 17, a girls' side. You've got 6, 7, 8, 9 different sections within that one club that are all part of that community. And it's not just the players. You've got families participating. Mm-hmm. If the players are at the ground and on the field on the day itself, you've got the family members, whether it's dads or moms.
You've got granny making the tea. You have all that in the background. Yeah.
Everybody is pitching in, and you don't have that in the U.S. The quote-unquote clubs that are there in the U.S. are really teams that call themselves clubs, but there's no emphasis to build a membership base or tie in with the community. Most clubs, quote unquote, they, once they get to 14 or 15 members, they'll actively reject calls and emails from people who are seeking to join. I know this because I've experienced it myself, and I know plenty of other people have. And there's no vision in terms of let's try and get to 18 or 19 or 20 or 22 or 24, so then we can build a second 11. And then once we get the second 11, let's get to 35 so we can put out a third 11.
Yeah.
And let's recruit young people in the community, and so we can start a youth section, and we can build members who can eventually grow into the adult sections down the road. There's none of that thinking in the club
approach
in the U.S.
To hear. And you linked very interestingly on your Facebook page to an article about how US rugby has looked to promote itself, like actively looking at players who haven't made the grade in other sport. And I wondered if that's part of what you're saying in terms of a lack of ambition in terms of recruitment. Do you think that's a way forward for US cricket? You've got to look at other sports, look at talented athletes from there and say, is there any way we can get to you guys, get you into sport? Is that an avenue forward?
Well, I think the process has always been they're just hoping for somebody to fall out of the sky and fall into their lap and just slot straight into the national team, which doesn't work. I mean, the fallback option for U.S. cricket development is to wait for other players to develop overseas, if it's in India or Pakistan or Jamaica or Guyana, wait for them to turn 22 or 23, wait for all the development to be subsidized by other countries, and then once those guys decide to go down a different career path as non-professionals and take up a different professional career path, and then they decide to take up a job in the U.S. and get a work visa, well, then if they're good enough as amateurs after moving to the U.S., then they work their way into the national team that way. There's no sense of let's actively recruit people domestically.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, to the debate. And in the week where England and Ireland contested an excellent ODI at Malahide Cricket Club, and where the ODI was won by two Irishmen performing in English colours, we ask whether England should stop poaching Irish cricketers.
Now, we were talking earlier on in the podcast about the fact that it was a nice thing that England and Ireland fixtures were becoming something, and we're becoming a bit of an event, and that we were sort of getting to know the Irish players and all that.
And it didn't feel like a token favour that England.
It didn't feel like a genuine token favour. And we also know that Ireland basically have big ambitions, that they want to be a Test play nation by 2020, and that they want to be at the top table basically. And my kind of question about this, you know, inevitably they need to keep their best players if that's going to happen. But my question is why England should show a special dispensation towards Ireland. You know, England don't say, okay, South Africa, in the past we've had links with you, therefore we're not going to poach your players. Why should they say it to Ireland? You know, if Ireland are going to stand on their own 2 feet as a country, they need to do it because they have a setup that people want to play for, rather than because England has kind of rejected them, as it were. It needs to be a positive thing rather than a negative thing.
But the problem is, it becomes self-enforcing. While England continue to pursue this policy, you keep Irish cricket weak.
But is it a policy? I think that's an interesting question. I'm not sure England does have a policy. There are Irish. I think it's not down to England. Actually. I think it's down to the Irish cricketers who come over here, play county cricket, qualify for 10 years. I mean, you know, the Ed Joyce example.
Mm.
He had ambition to play at the top level, and he knew he could only play at the top level by playing in England. And it's unfair on those cricketers to say, no, you can't
That's where I really strongly disagree, actually, this idea that it's unfair on them. So I'll give an example pulled from football, which I don't often like bringing into this podcast, but I'll have to do it. George Best, generally considered one of the greatest footballers ever played the game, he was a Northern Irishman.
Yep.
And it was a curse, I guess, of his career that he would never play a World Cup. Ryan Giggs, born a Welshman, yep. A curse again for him that he would never play a World Cup. In reality, you are the nationality you are to some extent. If that happens to mean that your team isn't South Africa or England, then that happens to be a thing.
Okay, so hang on. Would you have condemned, and this might seem like a ridiculous comparison to draw, but would you have condemned Basil de Oliveira, who couldn't play for South Africa and so came across to England, because he had ambitions to play Test cricket and that was the only way it could happen?
I think given the vast array of very specific circumstances in that case...
Okay, anyone who plays for
I'll give you an example. Take what I think is a more comparable example, Kevin Peterson, and I think that story is completely different to the story of Ireland. Kevin Peterson's story of South African cricket is one of failure. He failed to break into the South African setup. And that's been based on several things, to do with maybe him being a late developer, to do perhaps he claimed with the selection race. Policy yep. being based on race. But the point is, South Africa didn't need him at that time. They love him now, but they didn't need him. The point about Irish cricket is that they're losing players who they desperately need of high quality.
Who should it be down to? So the ECB has recently extended, not shortened, but extended... the time someone has to be, and if someone has to be in England in order to qualify to play for England. So they're not making it easier for Irish. They've made it more difficult for Irish players to qualify for England. Who should have the responsibility? So once someone's qualified, I think we can all agree that it's, you know, fair game. If someone's qualified for England and they want to play for England, they should be able to play for England.
The Irish players are making the choice, and I don't deny that, and I don't deny that Owen Morgan and Boyd Rankin have both made the choice. The point is, England are giving them that option. And the real difficulty...
But they're giving everyone... it's employment law as much as anything. If you live for 7 years in a country, you become a naturalised citizen, you're allowed to work there and have a passport. Therefore, you should be allowed to play cricket for them.
Well, look, if you take that argument to its extreme, you're saying anyone should be able to play for any country they want.
If you go and live somewhere and become a naturalised citizen somewhere and get a passport there, of course you should be allowed to play sport for them. You can't deny that. That is the way that the world works. It's like saying you shouldn't be allowed to work somewhere.
But I think the point is that there's clear... it isn't the same, though. It isn't the same. Because I could tomorrow decide and I could apply for a work permit and I could go and work in South Africa. I could do that tomorrow. It's not the same as saying I'm going to go and represent South Africa. It's not the same as I'm going to actually claim to be South Africa. And I think the real problem with this comes is that what the England have done that is so wrong is they've established this as like a done thing, as an acceptable thing.
I'm not sure they've established it. I think the players have established it by the fact that they've come across and done it.
I think the strongest example is the Boyd Rankin one. Yeah. And I would make the case here that England don't need Boyd Rank. I really don't think we need... We have enough bowlers. I think he's a very talented player, but in a sense, the selection of Boyd Rank in, for me, reeks of greed on the ECB's behalf. It reeks of an attempt to like monopolise any cricketing talent we can
So you think that if he wasn't Irish, they wouldn't have picked him?
Yes, I do, actually. I think we wouldn't have picked him at the stage we did. I think there was a decision to be like, hang on, this is a talented guy.
We want to get him involved
in the setup.
Interesting.
And I think if he was a comparable...
I think that's a bit of a stretch to make that accusation, but it's an interesting idea, the fact that England deliberately pick Irish players in order to stop them playing for Ireland.
I think if Boyd Rankin was a comparably talented player in the county system who's a standard Englishman, there would not be the pressure to pick him early to kind of sign him up, to kind of bring him into the fold as such. Whereas I think the ECB, I think there is an element of cynicism in it. And I think there's a very interesting case study to come on this. And a lot will depend on his ability and his talent and how he develops in the next few years. There's been a lot of talk around the fact that Paul Sterling is being looked at, talented Irish opener, is being pursued. And I think if England decide to pursue and donate on that cause, I think, again, it will show a certain degree of cynicism.
I think what we're boiling down to here is a distinction between whether it is, you know, cricket boards who are hammering it out and who are, very consciously having a strategy to kind of pluck players out of the Irish system, or whether players should have their own individual choice to be able to say, I want to play for England, I'll go over there, I'll do 7 years, I'll become a legally naturalised citizen of England and then be able to play for their cricket team. Anyway, I mean, it's a debate that we could have for hours on end, but that is the 51st. We've gone past our half century and we're now looking for a solid conversion rate. Here's our 51st episode of Reverse Hope Radio. Join us as we climb our way onwards and upwards.